Nuclear humor. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? There's really nothing funny about nuclear weapons and the entire process of creating them. Or is there? I guess it depends on where you look, your perspective, and your affinity for snark, irony, or just plain absurdity. And how complicated is it when your day job is as a legitimate paid foreign policy advisor for a nationally recognized institute and you want to make jokes? Is humor appropriate or horrific bad taste? It takes someone who is in this very position, a stand-up comedian whose day job is as a serious foreign policy analyst, or a serious foreign policy analyst who blows off steam at night by doing stand-up comedy. But either way, he tells you,
every movement that has succeeded, really ever, has had some sense of joy in the struggle. I mean, when they filled the jails in Birmingham, they didn't sit on their hands and weep. They sang freedom songs. And we're going to need that, because who the hell knows what's going to happen next? This stuff's raining down on us, and we need a way to sustain ourselves.
And what better way than making fun of the entire mess? Well, when William Hartung, foreign policy advisor by day, turns into his not-evil twin Bill Hartung, the policy-based stand-up comedian, you get a sense of what one person stuck in the thick of things does to help himself, and by extension the rest of us, survive that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with a foreign policy advisor who balances his day job with nighttime gigs as a stand-up comedian talking about, well, foreign policy and nukes. Our guest is William Hartung, whose day job is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, where he focuses on the arms industry and U.S. military budget. But when the sun goes down, with a swift change of first name, he changes from William Hartung to Bill Hartung, a stand-up comedian on military and nuclear matters, and who just finished doing a show for Jay Coughlin and the folks at Nuclear Watch New Mexico. Is this a contradiction in terms? We'll let Bill explain how the two go together. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, a variant on Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 24, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the United States, where saving nuclear power plants in New York State is estimated to cost $33 billion. That's billion with a B. That's the amount of money the New York State Public Service Commission, its members appointed by the state's governor, has just approved for every electric ratepayer in the state, including all businesses and nonprofit institutions. That's what they're going to have to pay between 2029 and 2049 to bail out just four nuclear power plants upstate. This includes 9 Mile Point, the oldest nuclear power plant of the 94 still operating in the United States, the R.E. Jenna plant near Rochester, which is the second oldest nuclear plant running in the United States, For context, nuclear power plants, when they were first introduced in the U.S. in the 1950s, were licensed for 40 years because after 40 years, it was determined that internal parts, especially metals, would become so embrittled by being bombarded by radioactivity that the plants would not be safe to operate. The bailout, $33 billion worth, would be used in the coming two decades to keep these plants, which have already run for 57 and 56 years, going far longer, probably at least another two decades if they last that long. The mastermind behind this is New York Governor Kathy Hochul. According to a recent article by award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman, Hochul has been calling for New York State to become the center of a nuclear revival in the U.S., to which Carl asks, consider taking a drive in a 57-year-old automobile upstate or anywhere. How confident would you be in its mechanical ability? We will have a link up to Carl's full article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 765. A new study by Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health shows that U.S. counties located closer to operational nuclear power plants have higher rates of cancer mortality than those located farther away. While this study is touted at the first of the 21st century to analyze proximity to nuclear power plants and cancer mortality across every U.S. county, it fails to acknowledge that this is information that has previously been put out by Joseph Mangano, an epidemiologist and the head of Radiation and Public Health Project. It is also in alignment with work that has come from Dr. Ian Fairley in the UK. While the Harvard study shows calculations of 115,586 excess cancer deaths between the years 2000 and 2018 among Americans living near nuclear power plants, Joseph Mangano points out that this is a conservative number that does not include excess cancer deaths before 2000 and after 2018, excess non-cancer deaths, and excess deaths among persons under the age of 35. Again, we will link to this story. And further on U.S. nuclear reactor dangers, we have previously reported here, now former Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chair Allison McFarlane has come forward with a warning saying that the NRC, quote, it's not an independent agency, stating that it has lost its independence. In its current role, the NRC is simply an advocate for the nuclear industry. It has no experience with or capability for evaluating small modular nuclear reactor designs, which are all experimental, and not one of the startups currently gobbling down federal funds has ever built a single one. Last year, Scientific American warned that eliminating independent oversight of nuclear reactor safety will, quote, severely increase the risk of expensive, unexpected nuclear accidents. Regarding Japan, with the 15th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster coming up on March 11, a new TV series about the events has premiered on Netflix. Fukushima Days That Shocked the World, also known as The Days, is a gripping 8-episode Netflix drama series that intensely portrays the 2011 nuclear disaster from the perspective of the plant workers, managers, and government officials. It focuses on the bravery of the group of 69 individuals who came to be known as the Fukushima 50, who staved off ultimate calamity by linking the destroyed power system to pump water up to car batteries and spraying thousands of tons of water on the exposed fuel rods. The show rolls out in 8 episodes, and it is well worth viewing. Internationally, our friends at the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, reports that global spending on nuclear weapons topped $100 billion in 2024. Spending by the nuclear-armed states, China, France, India, Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, Russia, the UK, and the US, increased by nearly $10 billion from 2023, with the private sector earning at least $42.5 billion from their nuclear weapons contracts. We'll have a link up to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 765. And it includes segments on what could that $100 billion have paid for instead, and who profits from nuclear weapons. And our friend and regular interviewee, physicist M. V. Ramana, has a new article out. It's entitled, The Innate and Inseparable Ties Between Nuclear Weapons and Energy. Ramana traces the development of nuclear reactors and energy back to the Dwight Eisenhower speech that introduced the concept of atoms for peace. And as Ramana points out, that is an extreme contradiction in terms. Again, we'll have a link up to the article. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Not your usual numbnuts, but definitely something that needs to be paid attention to, with pieces of a macro issue which thus far no one has been putting together. Nuclear mutations have been showing up in multiple locations connected with the two worst nuclear accidents the world has yet experienced, Fukushima in Japan and Chernobyl in Ukraine. This is a compilation from several stories over the past 2 weeks, all of them dealing with genetics. In the first, DNA mutations have been discovered in the children of Chernobyl workers. The DNA damage is from ionizing radiation erupting from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster of 1986, and it's showing up in the children of those originally exposed, researchers have found, the first time such a transgenerational link has been clearly established. Previous studies have been inconclusive about whether this genetic damage could be passed from parent to child, but here the researchers, led by a team from the University of Bonn in Germany, looked for something slightly different. Rather than picking out new DNA mutations in the next generation, they looked for two or more mutations in close proximity that were found in the children but not in the parents. These would be mutations resulting from breaks in the parental DNA caused by radiation exposure. The present study is the first to provide evidence for the existence of a transgenerational effect of prolonged paternal exposure to low-dose ionizing radiation on the human genome. In other words, exposure to radiation does really nasty things to human DNA. And a higher radiation dose for the parent tended to mean a higher number of clusters in the child and more breaks in their DNA strands. So children of Chernobyl workers are at risk of mutations from radiation damage to their parents' DNA, which was passed along to them in the wake of the accident. Also at Chernobyl, there is a species that seems to be immune to radiation danger. You just have to look at a different place on the hierarchy of life forms. Microscopic worms that live their lives in the highly radioactive environment of the Chernobyl exclusion zone appear to do so completely free of radiation damage. Tests of other animals that live in the region have shown clear genetic differences from animals that live elsewhere. The finding, published earlier this year, does not suggest that the Chernobyl exclusion zone is safe, the researchers explain, but rather that the worms are resilient and able to adapt to conditions that might be inhospitable to other species. Tests of other animals that live in the region have shown clear genetic differences from animals that don't. So according to a team of biologists led by Sophia Tintori of New York University who did this study, these microscopic worms, unchanged by radiation exposure, could offer some insights into DNA repair mechanisms that could one day be adapted for use in human medicine. Finally, in Fukushima, escaped domestic farm pigs that crossbred with destructive wild boar in the area reproduce more quickly since the disaster and subsequent radiation exposure. Why is that significant? Because domestic pigs reproduce on a year-round cycle, while the wild boars reproduce just once a year. Now, when domestic and wild crossbreed, researchers found that the year-round reproductive cycle of the radioactive domestic pigs caused hybrid populations to breed much faster as well, meaning much faster than typical wild boar following the 2011 Fukushima nuclear accident. The maternal lineage DNA actually acted as an evolutionary accelerator, meaning more of the wild pigs are breeding year-round, leading to higher populations and more damage created throughout Fukushima by this extremely destructive animal. And even as hybrids reproduce with each other, it's the domestic pig's reproduction cycle that holds sway, while it's the personality traits of the nasty wild beast that prevails. So just because the worst of a nuclear accident seems to be over, that doesn't mean that the impact is over and that it's any good. Be it kids, worms, or pigs, radiation exposure from nuclear accidents is having a continuing impact. And that's why the blind spot against looking at the mutation problem and how often it shows up and the variations in which it shows up and that they're all related, all of that constitutes this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Now here's this week's featured interview. William D. Harting is a serious guy. He is currently a foreign policy advisor with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Stagecraft, and he focuses on the arms industry and the U.S. military budget. He was previously the director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy and the co-director of the center's Sustainable Defense Task Force. Bill is the co-author, with Ben Freeman, of the recently released The $1 trillion War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. He is also the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. His articles on security issues have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and the World Policy Journal. And he has been a featured expert on national security issues on 60 Minutes, NBC Nightly News, the PBS News Hour, CNN, Fox News, and scores of local, regional, and international TV and radio outlets. Those are some serious creds. So what does he do in his spare time? He makes nuclear and foreign policy jokes for audiences in comedy clubs. Might that be a contradiction in terms? We'll let him do the talking. I spoke with William Harting, the foreign policy advisor, also known as Bill Harting, the stand-up comedian, on February 23rd, 2026. Bill Harting, so great to finally have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I feel like given what we do, we should have met by now, but I'm glad we're meeting now.
Let's start with a solid background on you. What is your professional field and how did you get into it?
Well, I have the luxury of pontificating about foreign policy and getting paid for it. I'm quite possibly the only person in America who gets paid to criticize the military-industrial complex. I work at a place called the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft because they couldn't think of a longer name, you know. In college, I studied Greek and Latin and philosophy. And I told my dad I was going to go to law school, which I did not. So I was basically unemployable. But for political work, I worked in the anti-apartheid divestment movement. And I was part of a small collective that put out a magazine called Southern Africa, which wrote about the liberation movements and violations of the arms embargo. And that's where I learned basically what my career has been based on was extracurriculars. So I took a class with a guy named Seymour Melman, who was an engineering professor. And he had a class called The Permanent War Economy of the United States. He decided that because the Pentagon will pay anything, the engineers were being ruined. They didn't know how to design for markets or cost. And at that time, the great fear was Germany and Japan beating us, not China. So that was the one really substantive course. And then I took a history of the decolonization of South Africa with a professor named Marsha Wright, who seemed like the most buttoned-down person you can imagine. But like when the liberation leader of an African country came to New York, they crashed on her couch. The philosophy was a little thin on substance, but it was these other things that kind of got me into this. There was a think tank called the Council on Economic Priorities, which was about corporate social responsibility. And they hired me because nobody else could afford to take the job. $7,000 a year.
And what year was that?
1979. And I lived sort of on the edge of Harlem in a walk-up. My share of the rent was $100 a month. And upstairs for me were two 60s radicals hiding from the FBI. And the FBI never found them. They turned themselves in. So anyway, I could afford to work for very little, and they'd let me wear army surplus clothes to work, which is a form of economic conversion. Essentially, I fell into this work, and you could never do that now. We hired two interns per cycle. We had 400 applicants, most of them with master's degrees. I wouldn't even have gotten an interview. So it was just a luck of circumstance.
So, what is the Quincy Institute and how did you get into it? And does it have a stated blue or red bias?
That is a great question. The Quincy Institute was started only about 5 years ago. It was supposed to be transpartisan, which is one of those words that it's not about sexual identity. It's about political spectrum, the full spectrum, right, left. If you're against military intervention, we can work together. And it causes more than strange bedfellows in this moment, as you can imagine. I'm a progressive by orientation, but I have some solid colleagues on the right, and I mostly focus on public education and linkages. I don't really argue much about our internal policies. I want to reach people who are not at DC think tanks because they're actually likely the ones who are going to change anything. So John Quincy Adams, way back in the day, even before I was born, said we should not go abroad seeking monsters to destroy. So it was an anti-interventionist. I'm sure he must have done something questionable, but anyway, they chose that. And the problem is not everybody's familiar with that. It doesn't roll off the tongue. So I was at a party once and I was so proudly said, "Well, I'm at the Quincy Institute." And the woman I was talking to said, "Wow, an institute named after Quincy Jones. That is so great."
Wrong, Quincy.
And I also have a thing in my routine about other presidents we might have chosen, like Millard Fillmore. We could have like Fillmore East, you know, William Henry Harrison, because he only survived 31 days in office and really didn't screw up very much. But prior to that, I grew up in a small Republican town outside of Buffalo, New York. And so kind of my Substack and my comedy is how did I go from being a teenage Republican to whatever I am now?
What, if any, work have you done specifically on nuclear issues?
Well, my first job was in 1979. And, you know, there was a moment when we thought Jimmy Carter was going to bring peace. And his campaign was quite incredible. I mean, he actually, well, my issue at that was the global arms trade. And he said we should reduce it. He said people always make the excuse if we don't sell, somebody else will. He said that's immoral. He wanted to do business on nuclear weapons. But of course, by the end, he was influenced by Washington, by hardliners like Zbigniew Brzezinski, and with the revolution in Iran, the invasion of Afghanistan, a lot of that went by the wayside. So I was coming in the last moments of hope about Carter, and I got hired to do a project called the Conversion Information Center, which was not about religious conversion, but about how to make your local economy less dependent on the Pentagon. So the theory is if it's coming down, instead of having people lobby to bring it back, they have an alternative. But then Reagan came in and it was moot because he was building up. So as part of that, I started working on the nuclear freeze campaign. And I wrote a report on how the economy could adjust to nuclear freeze. That in fact, it would not be a disaster, it would be an opportunity. And it was called The Economic Consequences of a Nuclear Freeze with a little dove on it. And I presented it at the national meeting of the Freeze Campaign, maybe in 83 or 84 in Denver. And the guy who was the labor outreach guy for them, a guy named Gene Carroll, is still teaching. And he came to my book party for my new book in New York. And we were just talking about, like, wow, here we are. I mean, all the same issues, except the movement is just regrouping.
You mentioned the book. You've actually written two, but the most recent one has the title The Trillion Dollar War Machine, the title makes the content seem self-evident, but explain to us what you cover in it.
First of all, I did not want to do this book. Our publisher, Bold Type Books, which used to be Nation Books, was looking for bright young authors with fresh ideas, which would probably not include me. I mean, I'm 70 and I always write about the same thing, but it was a trap. They actually said, Bill, we want you to write the definitive book about the military-industrial complex. And my thought at the time was, A, books are a lot of work. The world's on fire. I don't have time to disappear and write a book. And C, I want to write something else. But I have a young colleague, Ben Freeman, who's a great friend and work partner. So I was visiting him in Florida and we're on the beach and he said, I have this great idea for a book. And it was essentially what the publisher wanted. So I said, all right, let's do it together. Unbeknownst to me, he and his wife Anna had a baby on the way. So we signed in November and their son Ulysses was born in March. And he seemed to think you could have two kids in diapers and write a book. Not the case. So I freaked out. When I'm nervous, I just write, no matter, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. Thankfully, when Ben got back in the swing, he's a very good editor. So it's the easiest book in terms of my effort that I've ever written. And I learned a lot, which is basically Eisenhower was prescient, of course, but he couldn't have imagined what we have now. And we call it the war machine because it's about war. And some people don't know what military-industrial complex means. There was a focus group. Some people thought it was a building, like a housing complex or something. And since we've been at war, since anybody can remember, it just seemed more appropriate. Anyway, what we learned is it's about twice as large as when Eisenhower gave his speech. You know, the Pentagon budget itself when you adjust for inflation. And you've got companies like Lockheed Martin. They get $50 billion a year in tax money, about the size of the State Department budget, and likely lower now that they're gutting it. I learned quite a bit about the Silicon Valley military tech bros. And to be fair, they're not all bros, but they act like they are. But the Peter Thiels and the Palmer Luckeys and the Elon Musks and the Alex Karps. And what I learned is that, you know, the technology is dangerous. Automating warfare is dangerous. But these people's worldview is even more dangerous because they believe they are masters of the universe, put on this planet to run the world. Palmer Luckey's a 32-year-old gamer who created the Oculus home virtual reality headset, sold it for a bunch of money. And then Peter Thiel, who groomed J.D. Vance, our vice president, gave him startup money, said, why don't you make weapons? So he does, but he's got the worldview of a 17-year-old gamer. So he's like, he goes on TV and says, oh yeah, I think we can beat China. I'm going to make this technology that they won't be able to deal with. Then he said, this is nuclear relevant. 8 years into the war with China, we'll still have ammunition and they won't. Well, I'm pretty sure if there were a war with another nuclear armed power where we're trying to overthrow their government, it wouldn't last 8 years. And even the war games about China, they don't, like CSIS, this industry funded think tank, did a war game where they didn't take nuclear escalation into account. And even so, it was a disaster. Taiwan's economy literally never recovered, huge losses on both sides. And we have a board member, Greg Daddis, who's got a great book about America's attitudes towards war. He knows people, he was in the army in West Point. He said all the war games now are about how to beat China in a military confrontation, not about how to negotiate, how to lower the temperature, how to. So this guy, this 32-year-old kid who wears sandals and a little soul patch, presumes that he's going to somehow shape our foreign policy. You know, I can't even run the Xerox machine, but I do know that technology alone doesn't win wars. And that just because you know technology doesn't mean you know people or foreign policy or democracy. And the problem is the Elon Musk who wants to colonize space, the Peter Thiel who wants to live forever. When we were researching Palmer Luckey, my intern found an interview with Logan Paul, who I don't know, but is big into gaming. So it was at this, there's this game Tetris. It's kind of like a geostrategic game and it's old school, but they're reviving it. So it was at a Tetris competition. And so they're interviewing Palmer Luckey, who loves games. And he says, oh, by the way, I also make autonomous weapons, ha ha ha. And it's almost as if he thinks it's a game. One of his hobbies is he's collecting designs for games that were never produced and he wants to produce them. And one article, which I haven't fully verified, said he keeps old CDs of games in an abandoned missile silo that he bought for himself. So anyway, these people have the ear of the current administration because J.D. Vance worked in Silicon Valley for Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel funded J.D. Vance's Senate campaign. When J.D. Vance was appointed VP, that's when the money flowed big time from Musk and Silicon Valley. And his job as a running mate of Vance was to go get more money from Silicon Valley. And unlike Lockheed Martin, which try to deal with both parties, they're disruptors. So they want Trump to take down every like semblance of regulation of anything. And of course, deregulate crypto, which they're investing in with Trump as he's president. But there's an attraction to these folks because they, unlike Trump, their companies make things. Like, Musk said, oh, I'm going to put rockets in space cheaper than Lockheed Martin. And he did it. But just because he just do that doesn't mean he should tell us how to run our democracy or run our foreign policy. He should be a vendor. It's all right. If you have a product that works, I'll buy it. But they think, actually, they have an ideologist, Catherine Boyle, who works for one of the VC firms that funds this. And she said, they call themselves founders, like the founding fathers. She said, what makes a founder? The God-given understanding that there's something that has to be done, and you're the only one who can do it. So it's a religion, but they're worshiping themselves. So if I hadn't taken Ben up on writing the book, I wouldn't have taken a deep dive into that world, which is a scary place, but is also our world.
We'll post a link to your book up on the website on the page for this interview. But I need to ask, with you doing all of this incredibly deep, serious, gut-wrenching, world-ending research, what in the world inspired you to come up with a comedy routine?
I kind of fell into it. I needed a break, from this topic and from fundraising. So in the 80s, my wife found an ad in the paper, local elected official needs analyst with economics background. And I was not an economist, but the place I worked was called the Council on Economic Priorities, so close enough. And it was Bob Abrams, who was the New York State Attorney General, not a well-known name, but he actually at one point ran for US Senate against Al D'Amato. And anyway, Bob was a great guy. He had beaten the Bronx machine to get elected. He was ethical. He was almost like a public service law office in the government. But he had no sense of humor. And so I was hired as a speech writer. And his chief of staff said, Bob's too buttoned down. You got to put some jokes in the speeches. And I would do that. And Bob would not understand the joke. And we literally had meetings to explain the joke to Bob. And he would get it to where he understood it. And then it wasn't funny. And I had to try to get him to take it out. Eventually, I got antsy. I was writing a book on the arms trade while I worked in government. When I released it, I realized I couldn't really promote it as a speechwriter for the New York State Attorney General. So I got a new job. And Bob had this really chatty, fun old guy who was his consumer outreach guy, just went around giving speeches all the time. And so Bert said, all right, Bill, you're going away party. I'm give you $25 if you can tell jokes that everybody in the room can understand except Bob. And so I did it and I crushed it. People were laughing hysterically. And Bob's like, why are they laughing? What's so funny? So I was kind of full of myself about how, well, gee, I'm funny. But as you probably know, having seen comics, thinking you're funny and being able to do it in front of an audience doesn't always align.
We'll continue with this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person like you a regular weekly dose of nuclear news you can count on to be honest and vetted. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. Now in its 15th year as a podcast and 10th year as a broadcast over Pacifica, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. And we work behind the scenes with activists, providing links and introductions between those who are involved in fighting against nukes, researchers, and reporters, so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. That's why you can count on Nuclear Hot Seat to provide you with verifiable, fresh information and an unrelenting perspective on nukes every week. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. This show runs on donations, and we are always in need of your support. It can be as little as $5, the same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and maybe a bit of a tip to the barista the way prices are going. Or you can buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5. Of course, you can make it more, be it one time or ongoing. Your donation can be any amount, and it all counts towards our monthly nut. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. To donate, go to nuclearhotseat.com and there is a red donate button. Click on it and follow the prompts. Or if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's featured interview with foreign policy advisor and sometimes stand-up comedian, Bill Harton.
My new job was at the New School for Social Research, which has a long progressive history. It was started by people against World War I, like Charles Beard, at the University in Exile, of people fleeing Hitler. But it's become commercialized. They run Project Runway, and they're an American university. They're a business. But there's still a little bit of that quirky character. So they had free courses. My think tank was embedded in the New School, and they had a stand-up comedy workshop, and I could take it for free. So this guy, Scott Blakeman, ran it, and he knew a lot of comics who had made it. They were his generation, like Jon Stewart, Will Durst, Bill Maher. Scott makes a living teaching and singles night at synagogues, and he's huge in Amsterdam. So he's scrambling. But anyway, on the first night, you know, you have to bring jokes. So I had a bunch of jokes about Richard Nixon's sex life because I thought that was funny. I thought I was Johnny Carson, you know. And then Scott said, oh, no, Bill, you should do humor about things you know about. What do you do for a living? I said, well, I work at a foreign policy think tank, and my specialty is international arms control.
That's funny right there.
Yes. And so I naturally assumed people were going to go fall asleep. But you know, unexpectedly, people said, oh, God. We would love to hear a comedy routine about international arms control. So I was kind of stuck. And so I used to take declassified Pentagon documents on stage, like the Nuclear Posture Review, and read it verbatim. And I thought it was funny, but I was pretty much the only one. Then I did an impersonation of a ballistic missile. You put your hands by your side and you go on your tiptoes. And I said, you know, when I was younger and I could jump, that joke killed. So it became a little niche for me. And after we graduated from the class, you get to do a show. It was at the Comic Strip in New York. And thankfully for us, they put real comedians between the students. So like if I bombed, anyway, it was Fleet Week. And there was all these sailors in the audience. And so Scott said, you know, Bill, I don't know. You're going to do foreign policy humor to a room full of sailors. I said, Scott, that is our foreign policy. They're going to be interested, you know. And one of the professionals did crowd work. You know, where you ask people what they do and all. And there was some sailors in submarines and some in surface ships. And so he asked them what they thought of each other. And the surface ship guy said, well, we think of them as, the submarine guy said, well, we think of them as targets. And then they got so wasted, most of them had been kicked out by the time I went up. And I had a routine about weapons named after presidents. I was speculating at the time what they would name after Bill Clinton. And so I said, of course, a howitzer. This was a terrible joke, and that it was a howitzer that was a miniature, and then if you stroked it, it went up to full size. So I'm not proud of it, but people did laugh. And I also had a thing about how to come across as a foreign policy expert when you don't know anything. And I said, just take some telling fact, like, you know, did you know that Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso, is the only capital in the world that's got three O's in it? And then if people think that's impressive, you leave quickly because that's your entire knowledge base on foreign policy. They weren't great, but it was a start. And I did get laughs. I haven't ever bombed completely, although I think it's because I'm a little conservative. They say it's better to bomb and learn than not. So anyway, it was comic relief from the grim work of the day.
When did you start doing this?
Well, this was initially late 80s, but I did it only a little bit. I was at the bottom rung of the New York comedy scene, which is the bringer. You have to bring friends. One of the big clubs, if you brought 10 friends, you got 5 minutes. So if they spend $40 and drinks, you could be spending hundreds of dollars. And since it's a bringer, if the guy next to you brings friends and he's terrible, they're still putting him up there. So my friends are spending all this money to see me for 5 minutes. Eventually, you don't run out of friends, but you run out of friends willing to do that. And then I had a period where I was just depressed and it wasn't working. And then I did storytelling, like moth style. And then I did improv because I'm a writer and I work alone. And I did my comedy prep alone. And I thought, well, it's going to be great because you don't have to memorize anything. But you have to form a strong character improv set so you can put them in different settings. If you put your character in a different setting, they don't know who it is. It doesn't help. And then finally, we were in a scene where, for some reason, my scene partner decided she was a bunny rabbit jumping around in the garden. So I joined her, but I weigh well north of 200 pounds. The whole room shook. And certain people, not to be named, who are very dear to me, were embarrassed and said, maybe I should go back to stand-up. So.
So you did the rounds of all of the different modalities that were out there, and I'm familiar with all of them. I have done all of them and came back to, if not your first love, at least your safe space of doing stand-up.
Right. And when you do it enough, you do improve. But you have to have an audience.
Speaking of audience, you recently did a comedy show for Nuclear Watch New Mexico, and I love the title of it, No Comedian Wants to Bomb, which I thought was funny unto itself. There's a difference, I believe, in playing to an audience that knows your field and is on your side, and those who are just a general audience who are there. What was it like playing to the group from Nuclear Watch, New Mexico? And then how was that different than what you might face if you were in New York doing stand-up?
Well, Jay Coughlin, who runs NewQuest, you probably know Jay.
I do. I've had him on the show many times.
And Jay's a character. He's like the Marlboro Man decided to be against nukes or something. I love Jay. But he actually, even the night of the event, he said he came because he didn't believe I could be funny. He said, I've known you for decades. You've never said anything funny. I want to see what this is going to be. And then Susan Gordon, who ran the other group that we benefited,
Maze.
Mace, yeah, I've known her since my first book tour in 1994. Her kids, who are now like 40, were 10 years old, and she took me around Oregon where she worked, and she's 4 days older than me, which she always lords over me, like she's the person of experience. So in some ways, it's more challenging when you know people, because if you bomb, they're going to remember this, and they're going to tease you forever. If it's anonymous, it's one night. On the other hand, you know them, so you can tease them a little bit. It worked well. Part of it, because they couldn't put the two together. Book about the military industrial complex, comedian. And it's not easy because so horrible things are happening out there. And how do you really, you don't want to make light in a way that's offensive. But the saving grace is that the thread is, it's self-deprecating humor. I have a one-person show called I Get No Respect. My life as a failed foreign policy pundit. And one of the opening lines is about how I'm at this think tank and I'm supposed to be promoting world peace. And I'm screwing up so badly, I'm about to be fired. So the people who can relate to the self-deprecating part don't have to understand all the bells and whistles of the nuclear part, but it's kind of in there, you know? Whereas if it's a group who know about nukes, you can do inside jokes like, you know, they have these at the labs. The life extension programs for the warheads. So they, you know, God forbid you have a nuclear war and they don't go off. And I'm like, what about my life extension? What am I, chopped liver? So the whole nuclear language field is rich and it's been mined. You know, Carol Cohn did a feminist perspective on how the nuclear language, you know, deep penetrators. And also that if you're inside government talking to these folks and you talk about negotiation, you're soft. you're female. And it continues to this day. I mean, there's people who went into the Biden administration who were women who were basically exiled because they said, isn't this costing a bit too much? So there's that part. You can make fun of the language, all the bull that they push. You can be self-deprecating, but then there's still the consequences. So it's tricky. I had spoken to the World Affairs Council in Albuquerque, and I knew the guy who does their national podcast, who happens to live in Albuquerque. It's somewhat different groups, Jay's group and these folks. In fact, some of them didn't know Newquatch, which seemed impossible, but they came to the comedy because they thought it was kind of like a freak show. And then I have a friend who, Andres and I used to work on the United Farm Workers boycott in the 70s, and he dropped out of Columbia and finished at University of New Mexico, like 10 years later. So all his friends, some of his friends came. So it was a different crowd. They hadn't met each other, and I had to calculate that. Like, how do I? There was a woman who was lifelong State Department. I didn't want to offend her by trashing, but frankly, I said, yeah, it'd be good if we could keep the State Department. But in terms of nuclear issues, I mean, she would probably be more of an arms controller. There were abolitionists, there were people, anti-fascists, there was Green Party folks, all in the same room. So I wanted them to be together and experience something in common, put aside those differences for a moment, really more of a community building than a political education. I have to say, it kind of worked.
Do you have to get clearance from the Quincy Institute to go out and do your stand-up comedy routine? Do you have any overlords there who go, maybe you shouldn't be playing loose and fast with this information because, hey, you're supposed to be this serious guy? And also, do you get any kind of pushback from your colleagues for doing this?
They generally enjoy it. It was a long time before I mentioned Quincy in the routine. I may have to think about whether that makes sense, but I have jokes about Quincy. Like I say, we were trying to come up with a longer, more pompous name, and this is the best we could come up with. I've been worried about it myself. Like, I don't post it all on the web. Like, I'll send somebody a link to the routine, but you can't always find it. But I've kind of been outed because I did the annual fundraising gala for the Plowshares Fund in 2024, which is on the web and is public. And the organizer thought the program was a bit grim because they had Annie Jacobson talking about how a nuclear war could start, Barbara Slavin surveying the Middle East during the war on Gaza. Then they had the director of First We Bombed New Mexico, which I did not find depressing because they're fighting back. But anyway, the notion was this is a lot for people to take in. Let's have a nuclear weapons comic. And they couldn't find anybody else. And I had done, Plowshares does this thing for young professionals in Washington called Gin and Atomics, where you have a happy hour and somebody in the field tells you their career path. They invited me and I said, if I could do 10 minutes of stand up and then talk about careers, I would do it. And a couple of the Plowshares junior staff had been there, so they vouched for me. So possibly for the only time in my life, I made money doing comedy. They paid me. I got a weekend in San Francisco. And a lot of the donors were scratching their heads, like, what is this? But I also had the advantage, I knew Sally Lilienthal, who founded Plowshares. And she founded it in the early, well, when Reagan was going wild with the nuclear rhetoric. And Sally was a sculptor in San Francisco. She was 62 years old. And she pulled together her donors from the art world and started Plowshares. And a lot of the staff had never met her. She had since passed. And so I could inject kind of the history of Plowshares and my affection for Sally, kind of my bona fides. And then I only did the comedy at the beginning. I didn't interject jokes between the nuclear war and Gaza and say, well, wasn't that a laugh riot? And then at the end, I did kind of more of a pitch for we got to connect to our common humanity here. And there was a folk singer, Paul Pino, who works with the Tina Cordova, the Tularosa Bass and Downwinders, who did a wonderful song that also he threw Plowshares in the lyrics just for out of honor or whatever. So he had done that. So it was a positive place to be at the end. And I made the pitch for their matching grant. And it ends up Paul Pino's niece is in the city council in San Jose, where my daughter was pushing them to not put a gravel mine on sacred native land. So there was all these interesting connections. But my daughter got cornered by some older guy trying to explain how the world works. and I had to rescue her from that. And then they thanked me afterwards for mentoring young people, which I didn't really think of it. I just talked to people, I listened to them. And apparently, this is like some sort of radical thing when you're a 70-year-old white dude, you're supposed to pontificate. But anyway, it was a wonderful experience and unlikely to be replicated. But what I'm trying to do on my book tour is do at least one comedy event in parallel to the serious talks. And at some point, Quincy may sort of start wondering. But hey, I'm 70, right? I'm bringing them attention. I've got a little more flexibility than some people would. And if they said don't mention their name, that's not a big issue. I was on a podcast where a young man had seen my comedy routine and my serious thing. He said, "Well, Bill, I don't get it. You said you're screwing up royally, and so what's going on here?" I said, "Well, first of all, that was a comedy routine. They have to take that in context. Second of all, it's true. I mean, do we know we're going to win? No. But I'm not going to let them depress me. That's what they want. I'm going to push back. I'm going to fight back. Every movement that has succeeded, really ever, has had some sense of joy in the struggle. I mean, when they filled the jails in Birmingham, they didn't sit on their hands and weep. They sang freedom songs. And we're going to need that because who the hell knows what's going to happen next? This stuff's raining down on us and we need a way to sustain ourselves." So that's what I see this more like, not as a political education thing, but as a sustainment and a community building thing. And we're going to try out in New York something called Festivals of Joy and Resistance, where people from the movement, like I'll be the host and there'll be comedy, music. I'll interview people about how they got involved in this. And I've tried this out. And when I did it in New York for Peace Action of New York State, Peace Action of New York State is mostly people my age with a couple of young staffers. The refrain is like a Greek chorus, "Where are the young people?" Well, they came to my comedy thing. They mostly work on human rights and climate. And they said, "Wow, you mean these people have been working on these issues for decades? That is really admirable." And then the older folks said, "Hey, there's young people who care." But it wasn't about coming to a common agenda. It was just to hang out. So we had drinks, we talked. My first joke was about how for years I was the youngest person in the room at peace meetings. And my solution was to just keep getting older.
And my joke out here is that certainly in California, if not nationally, a young anti-nuclear activist is anyone under 60.
Right. When my daughter was born, I was 39. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be 57 when she gets out of high school. I thought I'd be basically in a retirement home. Now I'm 70 and I'm just getting the hang of it. But it's mostly because of young colleagues, because it's very energizing.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you feel it's important to get in here?
One thing I'm noticing, both in the serious side of the work and the comedy side, there's so much going on. People doing similar things in different places who aren't fully connected. And I think things like your podcast, and I have a little Substack, there's a lot of hopelessness now because the bad stuff is coming at us at warp speed, and these people are dead serious. And so some people just feel like they just don't know where to get their footing. But part of the footing is to create a space where you can survive this, where you can work together, where you realize you're not alone. And so I think there's a lot we can do on that front. There's a whole generation of researchers who've come to this because of Gaza, who found out things like how did the spare parts get to Israel? Well, they're sending them by FedEx out of the San Francisco airport. I could never have figured that out. And also on the culture front, I keep meeting all these progressive artists, sculptors. They may know each other, they may not. There's an old saying, you have to build the seeds of the new society in the shell of the old. And I think that's the stage we're at. Look at Minneapolis. There's all kinds of resistance, all kinds of formations. But they control the government. I mean, they have a lot of power on their side. And we have to work differently. And we can't use the tactics they use. We can't use hate. We can't use division. We don't have as much money. But on the other hand, living a life of joy and resistance is actually more fulfilling than piling up money. I don't really get it. Like once you're a billionaire, or they say wants to be a trillionaire, what exactly is the point? Is it just some sort of sick addiction to make up for other deficiencies? I don't understand it. And I think the younger generation gets that to a degree. I mean, obviously there's a split, but there's only so many people coming out of school that are going to get rich. I met somebody today who's does marimba music, African music, and is a barista. Now, obviously, her identity is the music. The barista is making the money, but she's not sitting there thinking, "Oh, gee, I want to go into tech and get rich." She is enjoying her life, and so I think that's the culture that has to be built. And I'm just literally, I think I'm just finally getting a little bit of the hang of how this is supposed to work. And I'm so thankful to my younger colleagues and these people who do cultural things and podcasts like yours, because I think we're not going to whip the mainstream media into shape, but people have to find the information and they have to have some sense of how to evaluate it, which is why I'm so impressed that you, I mean, you go deep. I mean, you're not just skimming the surface of the issue. And I think there's a hunger for that if presented properly. So I don't know. I just, well, thanks for having me. I mean, this is great.
Bill Harton, whose evil twin is William Harton, who does the official business. But you're Bill Harton, stand-up comedian, and doing a great job in spreading information that people would otherwise not be exposed to in a way that they can find palatable and perhaps lead them to wanting to know more. It's a valuable gift. It's a valuable service. You're doing a great job with it. And for now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Bill Harton. On our website, we will have links up to his latest book, That Barrel of Laughs, The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. And as he does any more shows or fundraisers for anti-nuclear or peace groups, we'll let you know where they are, and hopefully it will be time enough for you to be able to buy your ticket and go. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 24th, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. You'll find a big yellow box there. Just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one email. That's all. And that email will have a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. That way, you need never miss a single episode. It'll be right there for you. Now, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Yes, any amount will help us out, and we always appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear wants to be able to say is, "I told you so." There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.